Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Randall Abrams is a highly respected South African media and entertainment executive. With a career spanning more than 25 years, he has held senior leadership roles across radio, television, music, and telecommunications, while also earning acclaim as a prominent television personality. Randall began his career at Good Hope FM in Cape Town, where he rose to the position of station manager in the mid-1990s. He later relocated to Johannesburg to join the founding team of YFM. In 2002, Randall returned to the SABC as General Manager, Commercial Radio. In this role, he led the strategic direction of three of the country's most influential radio stations, 5FM, Metro FM, and Good Hope FM. From 2006, he extended his influence as a consultant on diverse radio and entertainment projects, providing strategic advice to organizations navigating the fast-changing media landscape. His leadership was further cemented in 2011-2012 when he was appointed CEO of MTN South Africa Music Awards. In 2012, Randall took the reins as Managing Director of Universal Music South Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. Randall returned to corporate leadership in 2022 when he was appointed CEO of Prime Media Broadcasting. Later that same year, he joined Telkom as Group Executive Digital Solutions. Parallel to his executive career, Randall has been a familiar presence on South African television, best known for his role as a long-serving judge on Idol South Africa, as well as appearances on SA's Got Talent. Up next on Celeb Savant, discussing his journey in the media landscape and his latest ENCA podcast, Both Sides, is Randall Abrams.
Where are you in the world and how are you doing?
I'm in Johannesburg and I'm doing very well, thank you.
Now let's rewind. You've been in the various iterations in this sort of media space world. As a child or teenager, when was the thought or seed planted that, I want to take this path?
Must have been about 4 or 5, I reckon.
Oh, wow.
And, I listened to the radio a lot, and I said to my folks, that's what I was going to do.
And then how did that then translate in you actually becoming it?
I spent most of my early years listening to the radio, like day and night. That's kind of all I did. I wouldn't say I was a big television fan, but to be honest, television hadn't really evolved in South Africa when I was growing up. As I say, I spent a very long time listening to the radio. And then when I went to university at UCT, I was able to join the radio station there. And then obviously that gave me exposure to what it meant to be in the business.
Now, actually doing it compared to wanting to do it, were there any aspects of it that actually surprised you that you didn't think would be part of it, which actually is or was?
No, not at all. It was very, very exciting because, going to varsity was exciting. It wasn't as rigid as going to school. Mm-hmm. Meeting a lot of people who were at UCT Radio who were as kind of invested in radio as I was. A lot of us, I think, while we, you're not ever going to believe you can build a career, because at the time, the airwaves hadn't opened up. We still only had a state broadcaster. So the only option was, when I was at varsity, was to join the SABC. And that certainly was not on my radar from a political point of view. So therefore, there were no real professional options in South Africa for me at the time. But that didn't mean that I didn't take it very seriously and try and do as good as I could and try and develop my skills,
And what did you study at university?
Political science.
After university, what were your next steps?
So once I left university, I got a job, right? I guess that's what everybody wants to do is find a way to derive an income. And then obviously there were, sweeping political changes in our country, the dawn of democracy. And at that time, I in fact did join the SABC. I was at Good Hope FM. I was there for a short period until, you know, there were rapid changes inside the broadcasting landscape. And I was able to become, well, to get on air firstly at Good Hope, then get a job there, and ultimately become station manager.
What does it mean to be a station manager?
So a station manager, you're the executive in charge of, you know, the success of the radio station. So all elements are kind of under your watch, from on-air talent to budgets to marketing to sales. All those elements will report into you. At the SABC at the time, we had a dual reporting structure in terms of sales. So there was an SABC head of sales in Cape Town, and then an SABC head of sales that individual reported to at head office at Auckland Park. And the sales team then also report into you in terms of your individual radio station. So those are the different, some of the different spheres that you're responsible for. But I guess the success of the station, both in terms of the listening audience and the revenues, are they're under your watch.
I've noticed that the roster on radio stations sort of mix around, change up. Is it normally they change up because, and maybe it's changed since then, but would it normally be that it gets changed up because that specific talent is not pulling in the numbers or not successful in that slot?
I think that yes. Obviously, the first instance would be how successful they are from the point of view of their listening audience. But on the other hand, there are on-air talents who are very successful from a revenue point of view, or big revenue drivers, even though the audiences may be a lot smaller. So they're able to deliver specific content, you know, so news content, sport content, economics content, where you're able to draw, you know, substantial amounts of revenue from an advertising point of view, but the show might have a slightly less narrow listenership. So I think it's not only about how many people listen, it's also specifically about who is listening. Uh-huh. And who an advertiser might want to target. So those are some of the considerations.
How long were you at Good Hope for?
I was at Good Hope for, I think, 4 years. And then I left for Johannesburg. I left for Johannesburg in order to join YFM. You know, the license had been won, and I was part of the team that set up the radio station.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So, and you've had the experience, obviously, with Y. Maybe it's different for different iterations. From not having anything on air to actually broadcasting, is it a long period of time between those steps? And what aspects of it make it happen that not necessarily the listener would know would be part of that process?
That's a really good question. So, firstly, you've got to remember this is 1997, right? So it's almost 30 years ago. And they were pretty healthy in days. You know, I'd moved to Johannesburg. It's a very young station, very energetic people. The technical elements are the key elements, right? If you don't have a studio and you're not linked to a transmitter and you're not going out on air and you're not fulfilling the ICASA regulations, then you're in a bit of trouble, right? So I guess that's the focus. The second focus is obviously on the format of the radio station. This was a youth radio station aimed at a broad target audience. And at the time, you know, we were the first format really to play Kwaito music. So a lot of work on, you know, working with a team and developing playlists and formats and clocks and all those sorts of things. We had lots of people that had never really worked in the professional radio environment. So a lot of kind of development work had to take place. But it was very, very exciting. You know, some absolutely fantastic people, all very much geared, you know, for the cause, as I say, to take this music and the voice of the youth onto the air. And I think YFM, more than being a radio station, was like a cultural movement, you know. People knew what Y stood for. You know, people would record the radio station on cassettes in Johannesburg and then send the cassettes to their friends in Durban and Cape Town. So you go to Durban and you drive next to a car and they'd be playing YFM, right? Obviously, they weren't broadcasting there.
Yes.
So yes, like a very, very exciting period.
Now, starting in something new, there's always the instance of, okay, we should actually do what is currently happening, what is currently popular with other stations. Yes, we want to get the voice of the youth out and play the music they're listening to. Was there any resistance to say, okay, we need to stick to the formula that's currently happening? Or was always the intention, okay, this is what we're doing and that is that?
So the license obviously is one based on your format, right?
Yes, that's right. Correct.
You apply for a license and regulator, in this case, ICASA, says, right, youth station, etc. And you say you're going to play, in our case, a very high percentage of South African music, much higher than what anybody else was playing at the time. That's the audience you're going to focus on and that's what you're going to go for. You know, so that radio station and its format was chosen and the license granted before I got there.
Ah.
But at the time, I was very, very assured that it would be successful. You know, I had seen that, you know, kind of big record stores like Your Musicas and that sort of thing weren't selling this type of music. But on the other hand, I'd gone with a very good friend of mine from university. Unfortunately, he's passed away. The late Bongani and Julia, I'd gone to townships in Cape Town and I'd seen people's response to this music. And he had told me about, you know, I'd seen where to buy the records. And I had, he certainly had told me about how successful it was at parties. It seemed obvious to me that if we were going to broadcast it and people could listen to it for free, that it would be successful. You know, if they were searching out these records when they couldn't find it at a chain store like a Musica, then it seemed to me pretty obvious that if you played it on the radio, that people would go for it. I'm happy to say I was proved right, but at no stage did I think that I would be proved wrong.
Okay, makes sense. How long were you at Y for?
So I was at Y until 2002. And then I went back to the SABC,
mm-hmm.
and I was the GM for commercial radio. So I was responsible for Good Hope 5 and Metro and for a period for 2000. So after SABC, I worked for myself for a time. I did some consulting in Kenya. And then in 2011, I think it was, I was the CEO of the South African Music Awards for a year. And then I went to Universal Music Africa. So the African division of UMG. I was the MD.
Obviously, moving from radio into the behind the scenes, you had the foundation, having seen the radio. Wasn't it easier transition to go into the label space, or was there a lot to learn?
So there was certainly a lot to learn, but I think, I mean, the good thing is a lot of people knew who I was. A lot of people knew I had dealt with the record companies, obviously, when I was in the radio business.
Yes.
So I already had, you know, a good number of friends in the record industry, and I was very close to them. So I had a grasp, a basic grasp of how it all worked. Obviously, this was the first time that I was reporting into, you know, an international media conglomerate. Very passionate about the record, I would say, that about being in the record business. And obviously, you know, at that time, it was kind of the, you know, something I'd always wanted to do. I'd always been into music. And getting into a radio station to me seemed a pretty obvious thing to happen. But to be able to be the MD at a record company, that for me was really, you know, something like the pinnacle of my career at that time.
And how long were you there for?
I was also there for 4 years. I was there from 2012 to 2016.
Going into your experience on Idols, was it ever a thought for you to go onto TV, or was it just something that just happened?
Never. It literally just happened. I wouldn't say it never crossed my mind to do television. I'd done television in the first year of ETV, and I was still at YFM. So I had experience in front of a camera. And in the case of Idols, I mean, it was very basic audition. And then we were on, right? Because also Idols, South Africa is the was the first English-speaking country outside of the UK to do Idol. So we actually did Idols before there was American Idol. You know, from that point of view, it was certainly very, very exciting. It was also the, you know, the first flowering of, you know, being able to vote via SMS and,
yes,
you know, from a technology point of view, a lot of firsts there as well, you know.
Having been in the industry for a number of years in different iterations, how for you personally and as your observations has social media and technology changed the landscape?
Look, I mean, obviously there's a dramatic change, right? Because, you know, if you're not successful from a social media perspective, you're certainly not going to be able to drive an audience, right? To build an audience. A few years ago, it was still a question of if. Now it's a question of how. I mean, it's obviously a dramatic change from a social media point of view. And one doesn't have a monoculture anymore, right? So you can't, you know, not everybody hears a Phil Collins record like you would in the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. So even someone who is a, who would have been, let's say, a quieter fan or a hard rock fan in the early 2000s or the late 90s would have known who Phil Collins was because they were playing Phil Collins on the radio. Everybody, respectfully, in the 90s would have known of The Sopranos, right? Because it was on HBO. Everybody in America knew what it was. And now everybody in South Africa, it was ETV. So you would have known The Sopranos or Frasier or Friends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, it's a quite different and far more parochial landscape where certain audiences, so there might be a South African audience, and there certainly is a sliver of a South African audience who are listening to K-pop, right?
Yes.
And it may simply never be exposed to any other music, other than maybe Taylor Swift, who seems to do a very good job of crossing over to all sorts of audiences, and people know who she is. But this wasn't the case in the 80s. In the 80s, everybody, as I say, whether you were an R&B fan, you would have known who Bruce Springsteen was. And you've probably have heard a Bruce Springsteen record. Similarly, if you liked rock music, you would know who Prince and Michael Jackson were. I mean, for me, that is the single biggest change. The other change is obviously that you have algorithms that are driving tastes. So again, exposure beyond the types of music that you might listen to are certainly a lot more difficult.
You referenced Musica earlier. For the overseas listener, in South Africa, we don't have access to any, if at all, franchise of music stores. I still budget for my CDs. Obviously, I get it from overseas. I love the journey of unpacking the booklets, the thank yous. For me, it's an energy exchange with the artist to say thank you for your hard work. I'm sure you are aware. Massive upsurge of physical around the world. 2 years ago in the UK, 5.9 million vinyl sold, the biggest since 1990. Last year in the UK, there's a basket of products that they gauge daily for exchanges. And based on these exchanges, they monitor it for some tax purposes. There needs to be a high exchange every day for a product to be in the basket. And because of the upsurge of CDs again, CDs are now back in the basket. And the research is showing it's the teenagers, it's the younger kids, not the, in inverted commas, older nostalgic people that are diving into this world. And then we have the platforms such as Spotify. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
I personally have been collecting since 1980 and I've never stopped. My observation of the landscape is very, very simple one. And that is that, I don't know, have you seen this movie, The Commitments?
Yes, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There's a really good scene in it where they're kind of hiring musicians, right? They want to start a soul band. The guy says, you know, puts out an ad in the newspaper. This is long before the internet. Puts out an ad in the newspaper, says, you know, we're looking for musicians and we want to start a soul band. And people rock up there, and the one guy likes Barry Manilow and the other guy likes Black Sabbath, and it's clearly not soul music. But the key about that is that people want, and especially young people, they want some sort of physical manifestation of who they're into. So they want some sort of shrine, which is why, for example, the Ramones, whose T-shirts were sold via maybe not H&M, but some of the other massive chains, UMG have got a deal with one of the massive chain stores throughout Europe, right, where they sell UMG merchandise. And a lot of people, some of the bands, certainly in the Ramones case, because UMG had the right to their merchandise, whereas Warner's have the rights to their catalog. They've sold 10, 20 times more T-shirts than they've sold CDs or LPs, right? And that is because to wear a Ramones T-shirt means something. It means you're cool, or you're hip, or you're anti-establishment or whatever it is. And some, with respect, wealthy kid in the suburbs can wear this T-shirt and think that they, I don't know, are living or going to CBGBs in New York in 1981. So people will always want some sort of physical manifestation. And a lot of those records that are being sold, a lot of those young people respectfully don't have turntables.
Mm-hmm.
But they want someone to come home and recognize that they love a certain artist, which you can't do in the digital landscape, right? You'd have to keep opening up your playlist to show somebody that you were a fan.
Yeah.
The other thing is that obviously artists earn a lot more money out of physical sales than they do out of streaming, right? So again, you're certainly helping the artist from that perspective. And the last thing I think is that, I mean, well, two other things. Number one, artists have been very, very good at limited edition vinyls. For example, Taylor Swift, probably the biggest record store day about 2 years ago was because of a Taylor Swift release. A whole bunch of Taylor Swift fans going to get this once-off album that you could only get on Record Store Day. And last but by no means least, the point that you make is that you want to see the artistic side of the album. So you want to purchase the album, you want to read the lyrics, you want to find out who's playing in the band, you want to read a booklet. I mean, there's a Springsteen Nebraska 82 album coming out in October.
Yes.
And I would have to own that because I want to read about the sessions he conducted with the E Street Band recording the Nebraska songs. I want to read about the artifacts of the Nebraska record. So if you're deeply into music, streaming is not going to fulfill your appreciation or understanding. And therefore, as I say, some form of physical format is going to be necessary. And the other thing is there is a pride of ownership, right? There's a beauty of opening up a record. There's a beauty of sitting down. You've paid the money. You sit down. You put the needle on the turntable. And during that period, you don't do the washing up and have a conversation with your sister and whatever. You are engaged in listening to and appreciating the music. And then you've got that wonderful moment when you've got to get up and turn the record around. When in fact, what happens is your brain has now downloaded all this stuff. And for that moment is kind of trying to understand it, appreciate it, think about it until you turn over and listen to side two.
Being in the industry in various iterations, do you think there needs to be more of a education piece for, and I put this in inverted commas, for the average music listener? The reason I say this is I was speaking to a group of 10 people a couple of months ago and then a group of 8 people a couple of weeks later. And I said to them, if an artist has had 100 million streams, how much money do you think they got in the back pocket? The first group of people, now these, when I say people, educated people, working people, all different cross-cultural sections, they go to concerts every now and then. More than likely, they don't buy physical, but they listen to streaming. And the first group of people's answer was $50 million. And the second group of people's answer was $1 million. And I said, actually, no, it's more like a couple of thousand. And they were shocked and horrified. I know Ray, Snoop Dogg, and a bunch of different artists have been speaking out about it. Without pushing it down people's throats, do you think there needs to be more of that education piece, or things will start balancing out?
Look, I think the artists will always drive it, right? So the artists are always, I mean, Taylor Swift, has actually been at the forefront of that argument about what people earn from a streaming point of view. The challenge artists obviously have is that streaming is really, really successful, right? So even Neil Young, who for a long time, or the Beatles for a long time, held out on streaming platforms because of the very low percentages that artists earn per stream. But unfortunately, or fortunately, streaming platforms are everywhere, and there are more people listening to more music and more diverse music now than in the history of the recording industry. So that's the positive of streaming.
Yes.
In terms of the earnings of the artists, I think that artists are recognizing, and it's not only a Spotify, the channels like YouTube, etc. So artists are recognizing that they have to diversify their revenue streams, and they have to think quite differently about how they're going to generate revenue, right? And that's not even to begin the debate about AI. If you're in the artistic business, I think you have to recognize that it's always been a rather tricky road that is far from paved with gold. I don't have to tell you that Vincent van Gogh, even though his brother was one of the biggest art dealers in Europe, did not sell a single painting or sold very few paintings. I mean, you could count them on your one hand during the history of his life. And obviously had, you know, massive mental health issues. So I think the arts are just a very, very difficult area to succeed in. And most importantly, you simply cannot legislate for taste. That's the other thing. You can bring out whatever record you want, whatever song you want, and you can imagine it's the best record ever. No one's interested in it. So that's the other thing that you have to consider. You have to consider, as I say, the percentages that are earned from something like streaming. You have to then make sure that if you're writing the music, that you're registered with a CMO, and that you're collecting your royalties, that you're actively checking on these things. You have to get a very good business manager and ensure that you, again, keep your eye on things and not allow the business manager to go off and do their own thing. So, as I say, it's a tricky, tricky business. But, you know, if that is what your passion is and that's what you want to do, then it's a good idea to do a bit of reading and do a bit of understanding and appreciating if that's the world you want to go into.
We're now going to move into this latest collaboration podcast. So tell us, how did the inspiration for this come to be, and how did it manifest?
So that's a really good question. I've known the CEO of eMedia for many years. I mean, going back to the SABC in the 90s. Just be honest, it was his idea. He thought it was a good idea. And he had a discussion with me. He said, would I be interested? And here we are.
What was the point of that and to actually releasing the first episode? Was it a few weeks, a few months? Did it take a while to develop?
Took a month or two. I guess, obviously, you know, we had to work on the format, and we had to look, you know, think about what it is that we wanted to achieve, the type of guests that we wanted. You know, the look and feel is really, really important to me. The aesthetic of the program is very, very important to me. So a lot of that work had to be done before I was happy to move ahead. We had to find a producer. You know, so there was a lot of that sort of, I'm sure you know, like the heavy lifting, right?
Yeah.
Took us a little while to get guests on because, again, you know, I think it's a lot easier to get guests on once you're on, right? Once people can see what they're up for, they might, in my case, have a little bit of aversion, prescription about entering into a conversation with me. So I think, you know, it took us a little while to get over those hurdles.
First episode, Helen Ziller, then Rachel Khaleesi. What is the thought process of who you want to interview? Do you have a list, a wish list, interview wish list, and you reach out? How do you choose?
I think that there are a number of elements. Topical is really important. You know, if something is taking place in that person's career or life that that we believe is going to be of interest to our viewers. So certainly in the case of, I don't have to explain Rachel to you, in case of Helen Ziller, you know, the whole question of her becoming mayor of Johannesburg. I have a doctor coming on soon, and we're going to talk about weight loss drugs like Ozempic. We're also going to talk about weight as a disease rather than as a, you know, some people are overweight and some people aren't, and the only problem is that you eat too much and I don't. So I think the entire, the kind of new understanding and appreciation and medical understanding of what the issues around obesity are, we've got that piece coming up, which is, it's going to be a fascinating interview. We're talking to the Human Rights Foundation about many of the outstanding cases that initially ended up at the TRC, and were handed over to the NPA. So yes, and I guess what we try and do is we try and talk as broadly as possible to a variety of topics. We have an international musician who will be in the country shortly who's going to be with us, and that's just an absolutely amazing, amazing interview. And she was just absolutely incredible, erudite, engaged. And we'll hopefully keep it exciting.
It sounds exciting. I'm looking forward to it. It's a nice mix of people and societal discussions and input. And you mentioned people and aversion, but it's about the authentic stories. And sometimes people, they're using filters all the time, so they struggle with authenticity. Randall, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
I guess my final message is I hope I do a good job, right? I guess that's all I can do. You know, I can try and do as good a job as I can of, you know, finding the right guests and creating an exciting piece of programming. My own sensibility is that I want to do as well as I can, right? I want to make this as good as I can. I didn't tell you, but when I was, before I joined the SABC, so in that period between finishing varsity and joining the SABC, and in fact wrote two radio programs for the SABC that both won internal SABC awards. I wasn't even at the awards because I wasn't an SABC employee, but I'd literally written and produced them. You know, when I do something like that, all my time on Idols, for example, I want to be as good as I can be. I want to be, for want of a better term, world class, right? I want to feel that if I ever got an opportunity to do this on a platform, on an international platform, I would be good enough to do that. So that's really all I can achieve.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.